This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 11th of March 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
there are two different Donald Trumps. There's the one you see on the stage, and there's the one who's very cerebral. And that's the Donald Trump that you're going to start seeing more and more of.
Ben Carson makes the weirdest declaration yet of his presidential run, a considerable accolade. How much is Donald Trump helped by the endorsement of the brain surgeon who gives every impression of being no rocket scientist? My guests Shashank Joshi and Martin Sanbu will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including US President Barack Obama's vague suggestion that America's special relationship with the UK may not be as special as previously. Is it really fair to blame David Cameron for Libya? The EU's deal with Turkey over the migrant crisis. Can the world's foremost club for advanced democracies really dangle membership in front of a country whose president nationalizes newspapers which criticize him? And China's increasingly unabashed and ambitious conquest of the South China Sea. Where will it end? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Martin Sanbu, columnist with the Financial Times and author of Europe's Orphan. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with Ben Carson, who ever since he first wandered into the contest for the Republican presidential nomination like a lost dog straying onto a football field, has done sterling work undoing the title brain surgeon as a benchmark of intellectual acuity. Today, sounding as ever as if he was reading something out at gunpoint without his glasses on, Carson became the second defeated rival of Donald Trump to endorse the game show host for president. Martin, first of all, the thing is, when you start saying incredible as it now seems, as applies to the Republican contest, there's no end to it. Carson was actually the front runner at one point. What, at the risk of prompting the obvious answer, went wrong?
Look, you know, the news that he's endorsing Trump made me think of some wisecrack on Twitter the other day when Ben Carson actually withdrew from the race, pointed out, well, it's sort of a sad state of affairs when somebody pulling out reminds you that they're actually still in the race. Because it's been some time, I think, that we completely forgot he was still in the race.
There has been, yes, a few of those, in fairness.
Exactly.
It's like me withdrawing my nomination for the papacy.
Something like that.
Don't ever give up, Shasha.
I won't.
You're still a young man.
It's not your choice, anyway. You get chosen.
I wait for that smoke every week.
That's right. What sort of difference does it make? Probably not much, because of what I just said. He'd been out, he'd been forgotten. It's true that he did lead the race at one point, but I don't think we can deduce very much from the fact that he led now out.
I think
we're much closer
the
to the much closer to the end game now.
I guess Shashank, he has not only withdrawn from the race, he's also endorsed Donald Trump. And Ben Carson is probably the only black person in America who could go to a Trump rally without getting thrown out of it. Is there any chance that this does actually help Donald Trump? Because the thing that is going to tell against him if he wins the nomination in a general election is that what the Republicans are now running against, that there are not enough angry, straight, white, middle-aged men left in America to get the numbers for the White House. And Trump, for obvious reasons, struggles with minorities.
We say that, and of course the tendency here is to crack jokes about Carson, but it is serious and it will help him, I think. It's worth noting that Trump has attracted quite a lot of support from black people amongst the Republican candidates. We may find that completely inexplicable, but it's an electoral fact. Carson, brings with him some evangelical support for Trump. He has staunch pro-life, anti-abortion credentials and bolsters Trump's rather weak spots on that, because, of course, Trump has flip-flopped on some of those issues and is viewed skeptically by parts of the right. So we can laugh, and we will laugh, but actually I think that this, along with people like Chris Christie, who may sound like hostages, but their support will probably count. And I think that there are lots of people who are seeing where this is going. Trump is likely to get the nomination, and they want jobs in a Republican administration. They will do anything to get it.
I think the last thing is right, but I disagree on the voters, because I mean, what Ben Carson had was the evangelical vote. He was competing for that, not with Trump, but with Cruz. And Ted Cruz has sewn up that constituency, I think. I don't think Ben Carson's endorsement is going to wean some of those people away from Ted Cruz in what now is shaping up to this two-way race. I do agree that we're now seeing, you know, it now looks likely that Trump will get the nomination and you'll see a lot of people trying to jump on the bandwagon
All that said about the evangelical support of Ben Carson, one of the many, many strangenesses, is that even... It's Friday. Of this Republican contest has been polls which have gone to Trump supporters and they've asked, do you think he's a serious conservative and do you think he's a serious Christian? And a huge numbers of conservative Christians have said, no, we don't think he is. And they don't care. They're voting for him anyway.
Yes, they're willing to, you know, it's a Boris Johnson phenomenon in part, I think. There's a sort of someone
similar
shaking
hair, up, certainly.
Which, I mean, slightly more detached, but, you know, shaking up the establishment. But in addition to that right-wing core constituency, he is also soliciting support from white working-class communities outside of perhaps some traditional right-voting blocks who see in him an alternative to establishment politics.
I think what we're finally kind of realizing is that actually a lot of Republican voters aren't necessarily, well, they might be conservative and Christian, but that's not what they vote on so much. And the most interesting kind of electoral cephalological fact I've seen is that the strongest predictor of endorsing Trump, of voting for Trump, is authoritarian attitudes in things like children's upbringing and so on.
Why doesn't that surprise me in the least? There's more primaries coming up on Tuesday, including a very, very big one in Florida. Shashank, is this the last-ditch saloon for Marco Rubio, isn't it?
Yes, I mean...
Even a thing, the last-ditch saloon? No, the last-ditch and the last-chance saloon. Again, it's
Well,
Friday.
I think it's an apt mixture of metaphors, because you know, he will probably be in a ditch by the end of the evening. So,
and possibly a saloon if it goes really badly.
Did you end up after the last-ditch saloon?
Obviously, Rubio has certain sort of, you know, the ethnic politics plays in his favor in Florida in some respects, but really, you know, he's had a bit of a calmer period. He and Cruz have sort of teamed up. There was some civility in quotation marks at the last debate, but overall it's not looking very good for Rubio, and I think the challenge for him will ultimately be how far, when to pull out, when to decide to, or if to black Cruz, and whether that will be enough to block Trump's path to the nomination. But I think we are going to get there eventually for Rubio.
Well, meanwhile, moving along, as America's remaining pockets of sanity wonder how difficult repealing the 22nd Amendment would really be, the current occupant of the White House appears to be enjoying the demob happy twilight of his presidency, availing himself of the opportunity to say what he actually thinks. These have included some equivocal reviews of UK Prime Minister David Cameron. In the week that the Churchillian cliche of the special relationship turned 70, Barack Obama appeared to suggest that Cameron bore some responsibility in particular for Libya's post-Gaddafi descent into chaos. Martin, Barack Obama is obviously a man who chooses his words very deliberately and very carefully. His phrase discussing Cameron and Libya was that Cameron had been distracted by a range of other things. Now, from Barack Obama of all people, how damning is that?
Obama really is probably the most intellectual of U.S. presidents ever, at least since the founding of the U.S. So this interview is just fascinating in how wisely he chooses his words.
We should mention this is Jeffrey Goldberg's huge interview
in the Atlantic, where this is one bit of it, but within this large context of Obama expressing his whole view of the world. And so I think the Cameron bits fit into his more general parts about the Europeans, yes, not really pulling their weight in the global security
context. Well, I was struck by that. His phrase was that he'd had more faith in the Europeans, and he was saying that in a kind of rueful, reflective term, as if that had been a mistake. But, Shashank, hasn't that been kind of a recurring theme of the post-Cold War world? I mean, you know, Clinton was saying this about Europe in Bosnia, and this is, you know, 20 years ago.
Bosnia, although in Bosnia, of course, it's the Brits and others who weren't so desperate on intervention at the beginning, and the administration which stepped in. The better example is Kosovo, where, of course, it was Blair up at the front front saying, get in, Bill Clinton actually quite irritated at Tony Blair for large parts of the Kosovo crisis, and it eventually came in. Eventually, the US had to bail the Europeans out by flying big B-2 flights from Missouri all the way over Serbia. In the end, it worked. That's the difference. There were children named Tony Blair. There are very few Libyan children named David Cameron.
It would be a surprise.
It would be a surprise to find, you know, ISIS-held territory with little George Osborne wandering around. But the fact is, it's because it turned out so badly. I think when Obama is criticizing the Brits and the French for dropping the ball, he's criticizing us for the follow-up is really a sublimation of his underlying sort of feeling, which is, I never wanted to go in the first place. In fact, he all but says that in this interview. He was dragged in against his better judgment. He's scrambling to find some way of squaring the line that it's okay now, they saved lives, but how can I still blame my allies? Now, is he right to do that? I think there's a kernel of truth to it. Certainly, we didn't do step up to the plate enough, but it does play into the myth that somehow we could have sent troops or stabilized Libya in 2011. Let's be very clear, the Libyans didn't want it. It wasn't on the cards.
Because the thing that strikes me, Martin, among the many things that struck me about the piece, is that it reiterates an extraordinarily and unusually for a US president, unsentimental view of the Middle East. There's no sort of grandiose plans to go grubbing for a Nobel Peace Prize in Israel and Palestine, possibly because he's already got one. I mean, they gave him that pretty much for turning up.
Yeah, the audacity of hope, I wrote about
Exactly, but he's extraordinarily unsentimental, and that impatience with the Europeans, I'm just wondering if there's a certain unease at large in Washington now about the underpinning ethos of NATO, and whether, if push comes to shove, America should really be expected to fight World War III over Narva or Dogov pills.
Look, I have two thoughts about that. One is that I think most presidents in the eighth year of their presidency have probably felt quite jaded about the Middle East and much of the world and the role of American interventionism and so on, with some exception. I mean, Clinton did work in his final few years. Nice. So Obama might express it more freely and more eloquently than many have done, but my guess is that the sentiment isn't that uncommon among final-year American presidents. So that's one thing. Now, for the Europeans' role, I mean, I think you're quite right that there's an exasperation in the US about European unwillingness to follow through.
Free riding,
that word comes up several times.
Free riders irk me, he said.
Yeah,
yeah. But again, I mean, think back. This has really been, I think, on the cards since the end of the Cold War. It was the superpower conflict that really kept the US in Europe. It was a standoff with the Soviet Union. Ever since then, I think it has been an American preference for Europeans to take more care of their own affairs and their security neighborhood, which is why Obama quite rightly, I think, wanted the Europeans to take a lead in Libya, and why it mattered more surprisingly strongly that Cameron didn't get that first Syria vote through Parliament.
But there's a huge difference with the Cold War comparison, which is that in the Cold War, the Soviet Union presented a major threat to the Eurasian landmass as a whole, and possibly, you know, threatening the US's global position. So the Europeans could free ride, but the US still had an ultimate incentive to provide a level of security to avert that domination, or what they thought would be communist domination. Now, Russia is a reduced state. Its economy shrank by 3% last year. It's in pretty bad shape in many ways. It can't take over all of Europe. And China's rise has redefined America's priorities. And so, European free riding won't be tolerated so much anymore, because these are
absolutely
not wars of necessity, like a war in the Fulda Gap or in West Germany, you know, in Germany would have been. These are wars of choice in Libya and so on. The necessity, the compulsion is in Asia Pacific. And the really interesting part of the interview is, as you say, him saying he doesn't care about the Middle East, but more importantly, where does he care about? It's all about Asia. That's what gets him intellectually excited, whereas Europe gets him jaded, the Middle East gets him depressed.
Well, we should add there's been a change of perspective in the Middle East. I mean, Iran obviously is important to him, so it's not that he's abandoned the Middle East, but he's given up some of what we'd become accustomed to thinking of as the US priority.
I mean, in a very drastic sense. And I mean, he's spoken more critically of Saudi Arabia than any president I can think of since the end of the war. His willingness to reconsider alliance structures in the Middle East, he's basically saying Saudi Arabia needs to share the Middle East with Iran. Yeah. I'm not even paraphrasing there. I'm pretty sure that's almost a semi-direct quote.
Indeed.
These are incredible things to say. And they show, in a way, the risk he is willing to run in pursuit of a drastic change in U.S. posture towards what he sees as secondary regions that are not tier one interests.
And his
Asia
willingness
is.
To think sort of 20, 30 years ahead rather than 5 or
Absolutely.
10 years ahead,
which is ironic because will his successors, whoever they may be, maintain that legacy? I think some of it is structural and it will stay. Asia is going to be more important for whoever takes charge. But really, you know, will it be that deep, or will Clinton, for example, renew ties with the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia and push back against Iran? In which case, this will be a historical curiosity.
Shashank, you mentioned legacy there, and I'll ask you each this, and I'll ask you for a short answer to what I realise is a big question. I'll ask you first, Martin, as a foreign policy president, how do you think he's done?
I think he's done poorly on shorter-term issues. I think it was a mistake to define these red lines in Syria and not follow up, which is also a big topic of this interview. I am, however, very impressed by his willingness to think long-term. I think his Iran strategy is probably right. Of course, it's too soon to say, and we'll have to wait 20 or 30 years before we know. But that is very rare and very statesmanlike, I would say. And it does... It does mean he has a different view of the forces that actually shape our world, the deep forces that shape our world, than most politicians do.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the choice between a president and a leadership that acts on impulse and destroys a country like Iraq, and one that commits sins of omission, which are still sins and still have consequences and problems, is an easy choice. I would pick the latter. I think Obama, on balance, has been willing to bust out of old modes of thinking. And most importantly, I would pick out Cuba and Iran, and perhaps even Myanmar down there as well. But that, to me, is going to be a really important legacy he leaves.
It is going to be a presidential memoir unusually worth reading, I suspect. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Shashank Joshi and Martin Sanbu. Coming up next, this week's one-in, one-out deal on the migrant crisis. Will what works for provincial nightclubs work for Europe?
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24 devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, in association with MUBI, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
Monocle is partnering with France's first premium department store to create a seasonal shop at Le Bon Marché in the heart of Paris Rive Gauche, running until the 7th of May. An intelligent partnership between the global media brand and the fashion retailer, the shop will offer an array of Monocle products, from stationery to fashion, from travel to design. Alongside favorites from Porter and Alphonics, you'll find several products exclusively available at the shop, including collaborations with L'Uniform, Maison Bourgeat, Arpin and Isaac Rena. Come and visit the Monocle seasonal shop at Le Bon Marché on Rue de Sèvres in Paris until the 7th of May. We look forward to welcoming you.
You're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Shashank Joshi and Martin Sanbu. Now, despite the purple-cheeked insistences to the contrary of various blowhard politicians and keyboard-thumping columnists, the only certainty about Europe's ongoing refugee/migrant crisis is that there is no simple solution. Indeed, it may be the case that there is no solution at all. The latest attempt at such, cooked up this week, will see Turkey take back from Europe those who set out from its territory in return for the resettlement within the EU of some migrants still in Turkey, among various other inducements. Sashank, first of all, is there at least something to be said for the idea, and it's kind of an adaptation, I think, of the Australian approach that if you have to take a ruthless approach to just deterring seaborne crossings by saying this won't work, you won't be able to stay here, that that will at least stop people trying and that will stop people drowning?
It's little more than that, because it relies on Turkey as a kind of safety net sitting below all of it.
So indeed,
you can't, I mean, the European Union doesn't have the stomach or the politics to be able to fully take the Aussie approach. But Turkey, in a way, is such an appealing partner for that very reason. It's sort of a deus ex machina, but it needs to be bought off, obviously. And that's what the last couple of weeks have been about. Now, the question is whether everything will fall into place in time for Germany to be able to sustain its approach. Because if it falls apart, if it doesn't, then I think Merkel is just in serious, serious trouble.
Well, Turkey, you described there as an appealing partner, which obviously in that respect, you know, geographically they are. But Martin, this is also a country whose president this week nationalized a newspaper for disliking him. Is this really a country with which we can do business?
Well, Europe has totally sold out its values in this deal. And we should add, it's not actually a done deal yet. It's,
indeed.
You know, there's still a summit that has to endorse it. Cyprus has problems with it. Greece has problems with it. The Spanish parliament has just voted against it, non-binding vote, but they have a caretaker government. Can they really commit to this sort of thing? So, you know, still a lot of uncertainties. But suppose it is passed. I mean, the key part of it is this one-in, one-out idea that Turkey will let the EU deport all these people trying to come in,
which is going
but
to be
in return taking people from there.
And that deportation, obviously, because of the numbers involved, is going to be an extremely considerable and, in many respects, I suspect, quite ugly enterprise.
It's going to be very ugly, and it's not as if it's going to end the smuggling trade. It's just going to make it rougher and harsher, because now what migrants will want to pay smugglers for is to avoid whatever it is, deportation roundups, expatriations, police raids. They will try to stay hidden from sight all the time. So they won't even let themselves be herded into these unsanitary refugee camps we have in Greece at the moment. It will be even worse.
One of the inducements, Shashank, is trying to fast-track visa-free travel for Turks throughout Europe in June. Now, whether you think that's right or wrong in and of itself, it does not strike me as something likely to placate European electorates, which is obviously whose hostility towards the migrants is already one of the things driving the panic of governments.
Are you suggesting that the Turks' travel to Europe will exacerbate these concerns?
Yeah, I rather suspect it might.
I haven't thought of it that way. I mean, I suppose it depends on the scale of travel, but I think we're effectively talking here tourism and other kinds of travel. We're not talking long-term migration, and I think that will be...
In theory.
Well, there is also a commitment to reopening the membership talks.
Yes, but that commitment is really, you know, that's the sort of softest is brie. I mean, they still have to fulfill 25 conditions, and that is contingent on political progress. So things like nationalizing newspapers is going to hold that up. You know,
but it's still easy to use as political ammunition in national EU politics,
national EU politics,
and in particular German elections.
Yes, you're right, but ultimately it's balanced up against the fact of massive migration, and that's going to wash out everything else you can give to Turkey. I mean, at this point, we could promise to, you know, give Big Ben to Erdogan to put up in Istanbul, but if we promise to stop migration, European electorates would probably take it. You know, we're desperate.
I think that's what it gets to. In particular, in German politics, where there are regional elections just ahead of us, what Merkel and others, but especially Angela Merkel, has to show is that she has something that works. She's got a grip. That's really what it comes down to politically.
But that's precisely why she's willing to give so much to Turkey.
Absolutely, absolutely. But of course, her opponents, even within her own party coalition, especially the Bavarian sister party, the CSU, are challenging whether does this amount to getting a grip? So people are casting aspersions on the deal. They're doubting whether it's effective. They're also asking, is the price too high in terms of the things that you bought?
What are the alternatives?
Well, I agree. It's hard to, well, you know, the better alternatives for Europe would be to have a more regularized way of letting people in. But, of course, that's a non-starter for some parts of the political spectrum.
It rather depends on the incoming people being willing to participate in a regular program, which they don't appear to be.
Well, they haven't been given the choice, I don't think.
But even if they were, and the EU, I mean, we still run into the same issues we've been discussing for a year. The quota issues, resettlement and burden sharing, those issues haven't been resolved either. So, you know, even if we set that system up, are we imagining a change of heart on the part of the Balkan states or other Eastern European countries? I don't think so.
We will doubtless have manifold opportunities to return to this subject, so we should move on. And finally tonight, we'll look at a couple of exciting developments in China's ongoing campaign of passive-aggressive conquest of the South and East China Sea. Not only does Beijing plan to launch civilian flights to and from one of the region's disputed rock piles, specifically Woody Island, but one senior advisor has suggested that the very same vexatious outcrop could become an offshore banking hub, akin to the Caymans or the British Virgin Islands. Martin, I'll ask first about the civilian flights, because mostly there's about 1,000 people, I read, on Woody Island, about three quarters of whom are employees of the People's Liberation Army and or their families. How significant are civilian flights? How much is this clearly an attempt by China to make it look like part of China and not just a military base?
Well, I think civilian activity is really quite important for two reasons. One is that you can pass it off as being non-aggressive, but also because, you know, by sort of custom and law, it matters whether a country has had civilian activity, continuous administration is one phrase, for some time. So it is a way of creating facts on the ground, which is why you might see some logic to setting up an offshore banking hub, which after the financial crisis you'd think we need like a hole in the head.
Woody Island is also claimed by Taiwan and Vietnam, and of course Taiwan is itself also claimed by China. You can give yourself a headache really, really quickly when you try to unravel the competing claims to various bits of...
It's a horrible Venn diagram.
It is a shocking... It's like the Schleswig-Holstein question multiplied by... something else of multiplied by Alsace-Lorraine. Say
that ended well, though.
Yeah, exactly. It is a conundrum of that order. Shashank, about the offshore banking idea for Woody Island. This is the brainchild of one Han Fangming, who's a businessman, occasional advisor to the Chinese Communist Party. Would that work, or is this just another way they're sort of thinking of in order, you know, establishing facts on the ground and or annoying their regional rivals?
I'm not familiar with the economics of it, so I'm not competent to talk about this. I'm normally much more familiar with people blowing things up in the South China Sea than trying to make money off it. But
counts as blowing things up.
But I don't think the economics really is paramount here. If you mentioned 1,000 people on Woody Island, three quarters of those are PLA personnel. So we've heard a lot about militarizing the South China Sea. This is very straightforwardly and very cynically civilianizing the South China Sea in whatever way you can manage. It's offshore banking here, but it could have been a theme park, it could have been a massage parlor, it could have been, you know, any number of things. Multiplex cinema for all, you know, or maybe Starbucks, who knows.
I would add,
you should write to Mr. Han. He seems like someone who's receptive
to
ideas.
Yeah, no.
You know, I'll retreat a little bit from my flippant take on the offshore banking center, because aside from the kind of territorial interest, I think China does have a pretty deep interest in creating a larger financial system centered on itself and its own economy. And who knows, an offshore banking hub could well play into that. I mean, if you're willing to let corporations avoid taxes in order to start doing things in your currency, in your time zone.
So this will be the financial equivalent of a special economic zone where the normal rules are suspended and you're sort of at a halfway house between operating on the mainland and doing so somewhere else?
I think that's far more detail than anyone has thought out. But
you should get in touch.
In exchange for a small stake in the new trading system that opens up.
Or they could give you an island.
Or I could have an entire island named after me.
Yes. Exactly. You know, Shashank Island. I think that has a ring to it. Martin, I guess, finally, does this fit in with a general overarching plan, though, of just China basically making it clear that this is our neighbourhood, we'll do as we please, and, you know, you and whose army?
There's a lot of thinking going on in China and acting in terms of establishing China on the world scene as a global player. Not all of it is coordinated. Some of it is more aggressive. Some of it is quite legitimate. So I think it does fit into this general you know, trying to find your place in the world, which they want to be a prominent place. And you can see why. It's obviously, it's a large country. It's a growing economy still. I mean, on the island specifically, Shashank will know this better than me, but it seems to me that it's less about the island and more about the sea around them.
Gentlemen, we will have to leave it there. Martin Sanbu and Shashank Joshi, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Marcus Hippie and Henry Ree Sheridan. Research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mari Giusti. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's music next with Carlotta Ribello bringing you The Atlantic Shift. At 1900, you can hear Marcus with The Menu. And then there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. But for this edition, I've been Andrew Muller. Have a good weekend, and thanks for listening.